What I like about the GNU is that the age of impunity is now over. What I don't like about the GNU is that both political parties are kind of rushing off to their favored media sites to leak information to make them look good. Mark, hi, good morning.
Good morning. You know, I'm back in Joburg and facing another week of rain, and I know we're not allowed to talk about the weather, but the one thing we need to reflect on is how grateful we are that we don't have natural disasters. We've got plenty of man-made disasters, mind you, but, you know, earthquakes and things of that nature have for now escaped us.
Hell.
I've been watching this Bangkok thing and this thing in Myanmar, and so far 1,700 people killed, and we've passed that critical 72 hours when they don't expect to find you alive. You know what worries me, Tim, is you have an earthquake like that and you're not sure what got broke, okay? You're not sure what buildings got cracked. I mean, there were some big buildings moving around a bit, eh? Swimming pools on the top floor overflowing. And I don't know whether you ever trust those lifts again, eh? What is your take on that?
No, it's true. I mean, it's also depressing to see very old historic buildings that in the time before, you know, building regulations, when people just built stuff, you know, just come tumbling down.
You mean like here in Joburg? Yeah. Like that.
Like here in Joburg. Yes, no, that's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And we don't even need earthquakes, which is, you know, puts us ahead, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is really strange how few natural disasters South Africa does have. And I mean, you know, it shouts at you, if we could just stop the man-made disasters, we'd have no disasters.
We'd have heaven. Yeah.
I mean, what?
I tweeted this week about the Beervlei Dam, which is there in the Eastern Cape somewhere, which is a dam that was built in 1957. Its purpose was to cope with flooding down that part of the world because there was a hugely fertile valley that used to get flooded. So they built this dam for the specific purpose of managing floods and then sort of turning that flood damaging water into slow release proper irrigation. And, you know, we don't do that anymore. We don't have that kind of foresight. We don't have that kind of investment in our future. But even for those little natural anticipated, you know, events, we used to cater. Yeah, the message there was we're just not building anything anymore. But we must be thankful. I've been in a mild tremor once. Have you ever experienced a tremor or an earthquake?
No, never once.
I've been in a mild tremor once. It is absolutely terrifying.
In South Africa?
In South Africa. I forget where it was. It was here in Joburg somewhere. And it was just a bit of the earth moving thing, you know, and I'm not referring to the present earth moving things, which are in my distant memory. Okay.
Yes.
But, you know, so it wasn't that kind of earth that moved, but it's terrifying, Tim. You are so aware of your futility as a little tiny speck in the universe. Okay.
No, exactly. That's right. And in some ways we are facing an earthquake too, because, you know, if we don't pass a budget on Wednesday, then there won't be any money.
Ish.
Would you describe that as human-made or man-made? I think you would.
I think you just might. You know, I read in one of the papers that even if the ANC gets together with the EFF and MK, they don't have enough to pass the budget. So that threat seems to have dissipated a little. But, you know, it seems to me that the GNU, we should talk about it a bit, the GNU seems to be still a party contest, you know, where it's about victories and failures and, you know, winning and losing instead of about doing deals for the country. Am I being unkind? You know, I mean,
a little bit. Yeah,
has the GNU worked? Has it worked? Is it working?
I tell you what I like about the GNU and what I don't like. What I like about the GNU is that the age of impunity is now over. The age that the ANC would just do things, and then we would all sit there, you know, just accepting, you know, all of the stuff that comes out of the parliament.
Yeah,
that period is done. And I like the idea of the original concept of the constitution was that South Africa, in times of trouble, you know, gets together and does the right thing. So all that is good. What I don't like about the GNU is that I do get the feeling that both political parties are kind of rushing off to their favored media sites to leak information, you know, which is designed to do only one thing, to make them look good. because they worried about getting the deal done, but they also worried about how it looks. They want to know how it will look. How will this look? That just makes the hairs on the back of my neck stick up. You just wonder. Like, apparently, one of the things that was put on the agenda was, you know, the DA said that they could live with a VAT increase if the ANC dumped the expropriation bill. So, you know, okay, you know, I like the idea of the, you know, sort of like this for that, you know, negotiations and stuff. The only problem is that the expropriation bill, really, it's a kind of dead letter. You know, it does nothing. Nothing has been expropriated in 10 years. So, you know, the scrapping of the bill won't mean less, you know, expropriation.
It goes to your point that popularity rules, not okay. Okay, because it's all about politics and popularity are what it's all about. All of the scourge that we face is a result of popularity overwhelming common sense or objective progress. I couldn't mean that more seriously.
Yeah.
Popularity goes to cadre deployment. It goes to the notion that you take from some and you give to others, and you don't do the hard stuff. No one does the hard stuff anymore. We don't go out there and try and make money. I read a number, 800 billion, that was collectible by SARS. Well, you know, that's much more than any VAT debate we've had. Okay, much more, a multiple of any VAT debate we've had. Well, why don't we empower SARS to do that? Well, I'll tell you why. It won't be popular and it'll be difficult. And the sooner we get over that, that's at the root of democracy. And so I don't want to get into a discussion about the virtues or failures of democracy, but it's not always the best outcome in a society that is not at the outset a homogeneous, equal society.
There is. I mean, you know, the same caveat about democracy, I guess, is applicable internationally too, isn't it? Because
Totally.
Whenever I look at another threat about another tariff increase,
no, man.
Trump administration, I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? You know, haven't we been through this economic debate for ages? Isn't the Republican Party the party of economic good sense? You know, where did that disappear? You know, so you can see it's being used as a stick to bash this one and bash this one and bash the other one. And, you know, and it's like friends are being bashed, enemies are being bashed. Friends are being bashed more than enemies are being bashed, which is weird.
What do you talk about? Yeah, you talk about swap ratios. You know, I see in Wisconsin or some similar such state that Musk is starting to buy votes, you know, or something. So we're now trading money for votes. Have a nice day. That's like, we used to call that bribery, okay? You know, and have we not learned? Let's forget about tariffs. We used to have currency wars, okay?
Yes.
I'll lower my interest rate and then you lower your interest rate. And it was like a race for the drain because there are two sides. It's not a unilateral impact. So you put a tariff on Canada, Canada puts a tariff back on you, and so on. And if you play that out and ask what was life like before and what was life like afterwards, I can almost promise you that there's never a win.
Yeah.
Okay, because it's a game of spite and it's a game of power driven by popularity that doesn't make fundamental economic sense. It seeks to bully the weak.
Yes.
And, you know, if you've got a trade surplus, as we do have with the USA, we're going to suffer, no matter how reciprocal our, you know, our tariff war might be. And if you've got a trade deficit, you're going to kind of benefit. I don't know.
Yes.
It's a blunt tool of bullying. It requires no intellect. It requires no long-term thinking and planning. It's just being a smartass, man. It's pathetic and wrong. I don't know if you want to know how I feel about it, Tim. Yeah.
You know what I think is interesting about Trump 2.0?
Yeah.
I mean, there's two things about Trump 2.0 that, you know, because everybody, I think, you know, when they voted for Trump, they thought they were going to get Trump 1.0. You know, and what they got was Trump 2.0. And, you know, these tariff increases, you know, they're much, much bigger. The total impact of the tariffs that they're imposing are by a factor of 10 more powerful. If you do the kind of, you know, the impact in dollar terms of the tariff increases that Trump imposed in his first term. I mean, this is just very different. And it's motivated by some very different, you know, people with very different ideas. And one of them is this weird anti-Europeanism. You know, and in some ways, I can sort of understand it. There's always been a kind of left-wing anti-Americanism in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now there's weirdly a right-wing anti-Europeanism in America. It's a very unusual phenomenon. And it's really the hallmark, or one of the hallmarks, of Trump 2.0.
Well, you know, here's the bad news, okay? Here's the bad, bad news, is that he's starting to talk about Trump
3.0.
So, Trump said, I mean, besides the mild irritation of having to change the Constitution, he's quoted as saying, I wasn't joking, when I was talking about a third term. Well, him and Mnangagwa in Zim and leaders all over the world, once they get that whiff of power,
right,
it's an aphrodisiac, if nothing else, you know. You can't bear being without it anymore,
yes,
which is so also prevalent in business. There are so many overstayed your welcome CEOs in companies that eventually fail because they become legacy companies. And I mean, like, we can see plenty of examples here and around the world where entrenched leadership, usually as a result of entrenched control, eventually destroys competitive advantage.
Okay? Yes.
And so if you juxtaposition that with companies who have very clear rules about how long you can have the job, and countries typically have had those rules,
yes,
then you can see which model works, man. Hey, Tim?
Yes. No, I've always thought that you should apply the nappy rule to politicians.
I can't wait for this. This must be anything to do with nappies involves a surprise. Okay, so go for it.
The nappy rule of politics is that politicians are like nappies. You have to change them quite often because otherwise they begin to smell.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's true for...
Quite mild, I guess.
Jokes
about nappies go.
One of the world's biggest challenges is longevity, in my view. Okay, in terms of economics and health and all those kinds of things and retirement ages and all these things. So it's a bit of a conundrum when you have a compulsory retirement age, but, you know, 65 is young. I mean, ask me, Tim, 65 better be young because I'm past it already. Okay. I think it's one of the biggest challenges to manage. But the politicians, they feast on that stuff, man. They absolutely feast on it. You know, we've got a busy month beyond the budget, eh?
Okay.
We've got SARS. We've got our revenue statement. The country's revenue statement is one line.
Right.
It is SARS collections. Okay. That's it. There isn't another source of revenue for the government. Okay. Just tax. Okay?
Right.
In whichever guise it takes itself. Okay. And so that's a big number, which I think comes out this week. And there are various other, I think, private investment numbers. But talking about private investment, I'm interested, if not intrigued, by this new thing where, for example, in Transnet, private sector is being invited into co-funding rail. And I read this morning that in Eskom, private sector is going to now be invited to co-finance transmission lines. All of these things, I think, were brought upon the state out of necessity, not, you know, purpose.
Yes, okay? Yeah, clearly, yeah.
And then so you go, well, okay. It doesn't matter how it got there. It's about time it did, maybe.
Sure.
But then you go like, well, who's going to oversee this, Tim? Who's going to make sure that this money comes in at fair market value and that this money is properly put to purpose? And so perhaps that's the real advance, is that the private sector might be involved. Do you think there will be? Do you think, or do you think this is just another take, just another pool that the government is forced to look at, just another tax?
You know, I used to write quite a lot about special economic zones.
Yeah.
And the reason I was always so keen on special economic zones is because if you have a situation where you have basically a high tax regime across the board and a high regulation regime across the board, it's quite useful to have a special economic zone where those rules don't apply. And it's instructive for populations and for governments because typically around the world, when they've been established, they've been fantastically successful. And governments actually got more money out of the tax from the entrepreneurship that happens in the special economic zones. So, you know, it sounds like it's like a good option, you know. And I was absolutely delighted at one point, quite a long time ago, to hear that the South African government was going to do this and they were going to have, you know, there was going to be 6 special economic zones. And, you know, they still exist.
Yeah,
the most successful one is Kucha. But here's the problem. The problem is that when it came to writing the legislation, they were okay with the idea of developmental tax base. And, you know, there were some rules, you know, were kind of relaxed. But the problem was that they required investment by the IDC. So you couldn't participate in the special economic zone unless you had the IDC backing, right? Well, that was one of the kind of some of the special economic zones. And the logic was the politicians were thinking, okay, we'll relax the rules, but then, you know, we want the government institution to benefit as well as, you know, the company itself. And there were all kinds of other things that were in the process of bringing the special economic zones into fruition that were added. And the result is that our special economic zones exist but don't work, you know, and that's what worries me about this, the private sector.
Exactly. You know, when is the government, I mean, I ask this with almost tears in my eyes, when is the government going to realize that the more they empower the private sector, the more tax they're going to get? Their purpose is to create and grow revenue, not to inhibit, not to restrain it by their participation and their first bites of the cherry and all of those stupid things. It is manifestly stupid or at best short-sighted to sort of hamstring private sector development when you should just be saying, go, chaps, the sooner you turn profitable, the sooner we earn some tax, you know. But that mindset doesn't prevail.
No. It's very strange. I mean, you do see it every now and then, but the notion of government celebrating, you know, sort of business innovation and success, it's quite rare, actually. You know, every now and then, you know, so a politician cuts a ribbon at the Ford factory when there's big investment, you know, because the idea of investment, I think that's kind of penetrated this as a positive thing. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, worries me is South Africa's Competition Commission has just prevented the merger internet by fiber optic cable. This is the sort of Vumatel from being bought by Vodacom. This sort of strikes me so much. And the Department of Trade and Industry supports this deal. I mean, it's just strange. The Department of Trade and Industry, notionally, Competition Commission falls under their jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And they like this deal, but yet they're being overruled by their own subset. I mean, it's very strange, it's a very unusual situation.
Tim, once you've understood that, you could move to the Karoo and live happily ever after. You know, that's what I would do. once you've got that figured out, you're way ahead of the end game, you know. I mean, I'm sorry. No. But so the first rule of attracting investment is in the adjective attracting. I mean, or in the, what is it, the thing, in attracting.
Yes.
Because if the ground isn't fertile, the money ain't coming. So when if these things are well trodden. We just are dealing with a different species when it comes to political popularity trumping economic and business sense. And I don't know how we cross that bridge other than desperation, which is where I think we are. I think these invitations for private sector participation are born out of desperation. And I don't care as long as they happen, because I actually think they will, if nothing else, in practice, demonstrate their own virtue.
Yes.
And so may that be the case.
Yeah, no, totally true. I'm with you, totally. But it does worry me. The fact that they are born out of desperation does make you wonder whether when it comes down to actually, you know, signing the regulations, whether it will come out in the way that we are hoping it will come out. We will see.
No, but of course it won't. I mean, where do you live, man? You know.
I'm living happily ever after in the Karoo.
That's what we've lost faith in. We're not an outcomes-driven decision-making entity. We're an incomes-driven, inputs-driven decision-making entity, which is another fundamental flaw. Anyway, I was talking, we haven't had numbers on this program for ages.
Can I mention one?
Yeah, go.
Right. I've got a number for you. Well, I've at least got a fact. I mean, it's not really a number. It is a number. There is a number. Okay.
So make up your mind, man. Just, you know, go for it. Take a risk. We've got editors. Yeah.
What, according to the latest survey, is the best migration destination in 2025? What is the best country to move to, according to people who put these stuff together?
Well, it's not Greenland.
Yes.
I don't know.
This is interesting, not for the reason that you might think. The country that comes out on top is Switzerland, and the second country is Singapore. And you know what strikes me about both of those places?
Money, eh?
Yeah. Well, there's money for a start, but also smallness. It used to be the best place to migrate to was a big country, because then you'd be safe. And now people are much less concerned about safeness than the money.
It might be small, but density in Singapore is not trivial. Okay, so there are quite a few people that fit into that small place. Okay.
Yes. No. It is interesting.
You've forgotten what city life's like living out as you do in the desert. So I still favour the desert over the city. So I'm not sure. You know, I heard that the ANC Youth League had a sort of wine and dine at a hotel and then left. Okay, didn't pay the bill of 870,000 rand. That was a bit of skin.
That's your number for the week. Yeah, I
mean, that's my number for the week. And I'm like, but that's quite a meal, eh? And you know, A and B.
I don't know. That's not so much. Depends on how many people there were.
Well, you know, I suppose if you take the champagne off the bill, there's so much to celebrate. One can expect the bills to be high. We've got a lot of holidays and a lot of important economic matters happening in April. May it be a good one.
Thank you very much. Okay. Cheers, Mark.
Ciao.